Morning, everyone. Welcome to this year's open house at Columbia University's Lamont campus. I'm Mike Purdy. I have the privilege of being director here and would like to thank you for coming. This is the one day each year that we open our campus to our neighbors, and it's a real joy to see so many folks interested in learning about what we do here. So welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today. It's always a challenge for us as academic researchers to figure out how to bridge the chasm between the way we think and the way we follow our obsessive quest for new knowledge, and the way that the general public perceives science with all its complexities and uncertainties. We're fortunate this morning, however, to have one of the world's greatest and most recognized communicators to tackle this challenge and talk to us about probably the most fundamental issue to face our children and our children's children in this century and the next. And that's the new strategies that this nation must adopt if it is to ensure its energy security into the future. So, doggone it, what the heck, I'd better get on with it. Don't laugh. We're all going to be talking like that, and I've started practicing. It's my privilege to introduce Professor Jeff Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute here at Columbia University and the Quetelet Professor of Sustainable Development and Professor of Health Policy and Management. Jeff is undoubtedly the leading international economic advisor of his generation. For more than 20 years, he has been the world's most articulate and effective voice, establishing the imperative of combining economic development with environmental sustainability. He is special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and as director of the Earth Institute here at Columbia, leads large-scale efforts to promote the mitigation of human-induced climate change. This morning, Jeff has chosen, as always, a small and modest subject for his discourse, a new energy strategy for the United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege for me to introduce Professor Jeffrey Sachs.
Gosh darn, you are a maverick. That's amazing. Can we give a big hand for Mike Purdy? This is an astounding institution. I know you all know it. That's why you're here. But I can't tell you how important Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory is to the future of the world. The most important science is being done here, absolutely critical for our understanding of the Earth, and the more we understand about the Earth, the more we understand that that knowledge is critical for our future. What's being done here in climate, in water, in the carbon cycle, in the impacts of human-induced change on the Earth's physical environment and the U.S. physical environment is astounding. It's a breakthrough every day. For me, it's an incredible joy and privilege. And Mike, who I think slipped out the back of the room for a moment, is such a talented and marvelous leader of this institution. It's big, complex. It has heavy funding needs, heavy research grant needs, many different components to it in a difficult environment for science in general during this administration, in a difficult financial environment, and with an incredibly complex scientific agenda. And we could not be luckier to have Mike Purdy heading this place. So I just wanted to let you know this is really very, very special and very, very important what he does. You're going to hear a lot of great science today as both as you walk around the beautiful campus and also as you hear talks in the room. And, of course, I'm not a scientist. I don't even think I could say I'm a social scientist, although that's what economists like to think. The best definition I heard recently of an economist is a person put on this planet to make astrologers look good. We're having a hard time with our science because we get crack-ups of events that are highly nonlinear and highly unpredicted. But I am a tremendous consumer of science because the bridge between what is known in science and what we need to know for our well-being is more important than ever. And the bridge is obviously vast. The gap, I should say, is vast. And the bridge that we need to build is a big one and a very difficult one right now. As director here, it's an unbelievable privilege to be able to pick up the phone on any question that comes up and talk to a world expert within a few minutes to find out what the real story is on a news story or breaking scientific finding. But clearly, as a country, we don't have that capacity right now. And the gap between what's known, what you could read about in the scientific journals, what is discovered here, and what's acted upon in Washington can be a gap of 10 years, 20 years. It can be a gap that's so dangerous that we're thrown into a massive and growing crisis. I'm not wildly optimistic about our times right now, although I'm an optimist at heart and know that we'll see our way through this. But what I think is the reason for concern is how far off track we are right now, not only in chosen strategies, but in our near incapacity to have a normal discussion about this. Drill, baby, drill is not a sound strategy for U.S. energy policy for the 21st century. The glee with which it's felt around the country is a horror, actually, that it's championed by someone who has absolutely no business being anywhere near our national leadership. Is also a sign of, I'm not partisan, by the way, I'm not partisan, I'm horrified. I want to put aside the drill, baby, drill for in one sentence. If we drilled everything, if we wrecked every natural environment, if we put all our offshore and Alaskan refuge areas at tremendous environmental peril, we might find 20 billion barrels of oil, which would be right now about 7 months of global production. And if we take into account that the world economy is growing, by the time in 10 or 15 years it starts to come online, it might constitute 3 months. I don't mean 3 months per year. I mean 3 months forever. This is the biggest phony non-issue by the biggest ignoramus administration we ever had. And so this has nothing to do with the real energy strategy at all. Now that I'm warmed up, I don't really even want to talk too much about energy strategy for a moment because I want to talk about national strategy just for a few minutes because I am a macroeconomist and I do know something about what's happening right now. And I thought I could explain for a few minutes why we're in this crisis and what I would like to see as a change if we're lucky enough to have rationality reappear in our national politics. So we're clearly in a terrible financial crisis, and it's worth very quickly, maybe 10 minutes, to understand some of the roots of this crisis and some of what it means about how we have comported ourselves nationally and what our real choices are for the future. It starts, I think, back around the beginning of the Reagan administration, because we're basically at the end of the Reagan era, which has gone on for about 30 years now. And nothing really changed very much during the Clinton years, except there was a Democratic president who didn't deflect the needle very much. He was saner, less likely to get us into deep trouble, but didn't really change the basic direction. The basic direction was, for about 30 years, we said we wouldn't tax ourselves very much, keep taxes low, don't do anything very ambitious on public policy at all, whether it's on climate, on energy systems, on physical infrastructure. We've done basically no national initiatives on anything in the public sphere for 30 years. And we would rely on deregulating markets, and somehow markets were meant to solve these problems. Markets do not solve many kinds of problems inherently. Markets do not build infrastructure. Markets do not self-regulate financial flows, which are highly leveraged and therefore highly vulnerable to shocks and abuse and self-serving dealing. Markets do not attend to the physical environment by themselves, because the signals that markets give are that it's free to dump carbon dioxide into the air, or free to harvest species being driven to extinction, unless government changes the signals in a direct way. So markets cannot attend to the problems of environment by themselves. You can use market-type instruments, but those are tricks that may or may not be a good idea, like carbon permits or sulfur oxide tradable permits, or individual tradable quotas for fisheries. Those are market-type instruments of a public policy framework. But we've not had public policy. We've had a concerted period of public neglect. The idea, let that free market do it. It's wonderful. Get government off the backs of the people until the $700 billion bailout, or until the collapse of climate, or until the bridges collapse, or until the fisheries run out in the Northeast and then the Northwest, or until the drought hits the whole Southwest of America, where we've had our biggest housing and development boom of the last 40 years. Then you'll get the price tag, like we're getting right now. You won't get money for value, because it's just going to be plugging phenomenal holes. But the philosophy has been, just get out of the way, because the wonders of the market will do it. But a large part of serious economic science is to understand what markets do and what they don't do. And markets do not attend to infrastructure. Markets do not attend to the environment. Markets do not attend to regulation. And markets do not attend to the poorest of the poor, that area that I spend a lot of my time on. Markets leave extremely poor people to die, which I happen to think is also a bad idea, because people don't need a lot to stay alive. They need clean water and basic food and basic health care, and that turns out to be about 1% of the income of the rich world. And I don't like to see 10 million children die a year because we've not been able to find the gumption for that. So we've been in a philosophical era where government was the problem. That's what Ronald Reagan told us. Government's the problem. And the solution is to get government off our backs, and that's what we've done. So we've solved no problems now for nearly 30 years about the environment, about extreme poverty, about a legal and regulatory framework for a working market economy. Things have been allowed to run on their way. Markets do certain things. They create incentives. They can build incomes, but only if they're part of an ordered, law-based, ecologically sound and sustainable framework, which we don't have right now in this country. And because the United States used to be a world leader and it now is completely absent from the world scene, except in these two absurd wars that we're fighting. Otherwise, we're not at any international negotiations, I can tell you, because I live in those negotiating rooms. Not a lot of fun, by the way. But we're not even there. We don't play a role. We don't provide intellectual leadership. We don't put money on the table. We don't do anything. Last week I'm rambling a little bit because I'm just venting it for you. But I'm actually going to come to a point. But I'll vent for another minute or two. Last week, the UN took up the issue of hunger, poverty, and disease, called the Millennium Development Goals. That was a week that was the midpoint of this 15-year effort, which I've been involved in with two secretaries general now. George Bush came, gave a speech. This is the Millennium Development Goal week. You'd think he'd have the gumption to mention it even once. The speech, when you read it, or listen to it, which I did for half of it, was horrifying. It mentions terrorism or terror or terrorists 31 times, tyranny 7 times, Millennium Development Goals 0, climate 0, environment 0, poverty 1. And there are 190 world leaders that have a lot of problems on drought, climate, hunger, poverty. And that's the message of the President of the United States. So that's how far off we are, how weird it is. But you watch our debates, you'd never know it also. Because we're really far off track of normal right now. We're just gripped in abnormal. So what happened in this most recent crisis is that the financial markets were deregulated, and they started to find ways to channel saving into riskier and riskier investments, taking their fees and their bonuses along the way. And unfortunately, it's our people here, people we're involved with down the block in Wall Street, which set up new kinds of what has now become called shadow banking, basically incredibly leveraged legal vehicles, structured investment vehicles, to take what's supposed to be safe money from money markets, money invested in short-term commercial paper, money coming from abroad because the U.S. system is safe, and it was channeled increasingly into more and more dubious, especially housing loans, home equity, mortgage-backed securities, and consumer loans of all kinds. And this reached truly enormous proportions, trillions of dollars of loans coming in, packaged as safe, and lending money to households that could not afford to repay the loans, taking on teaser mortgages, no down payment mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, and many, many other come-ons. And trillions of dollars went this way. As it went, the housing markets boomed. We know it here. We had one of the biggest booms. The housing markets boomed, house prices went up, and the lenders thought, well, that's my security anyway. We always have a foreclosure, a mortgage repayment. But the housing markets boomed because of the easy credit. The easy credit stopped about 18 months ago, and the rest has just been a train wreck in slow motion, which still continues. because when the easy lending stopped, as cracks in this self-feeding process became evident, and a couple early funds started to fail, and so loans started to pull back, then the housing prices started to go down. Then the mortgages got underwater because housing values were lower than the mortgage values. Then foreclosure rates started to rise. Then the lending into these facilities started to slow more. Then the housing prices started to collapse faster, of course. It's just the unwinding of the bubble that was rising. Then last year, Wall Street basically closed up in this way of channeling funds. So the real economy, meaning people hammering houses together, started to see unemployment, a slowdown of housing starts from a peak of about 2.5 million per year, down to 1.5 million, now under 1 million, because of the direct drying up of credits. Then the banks and the investment banks had to take their shadow portfolios back onto their balance sheets one way or another. And then we saw how badly impaired the capital of the banking sector is. And that meant that banks had to retrench even more on their loans because the commercial banks, not the investment banks, which were leveraged 30 or 50 to 1, but the commercial banks, which have maximum leverage under capital adequacy standards of 10 to 1, had their bank capital reduced, so all the assets that they had lent on top of shrunken capital now have to be reduced. So you have to call in loans, or you have to stop making new loans, and that leads to a further downward spiral. So the economy starts to go down because people can't get loans. Then a crack-up occurred earlier last month when Lehman Brothers failed, and that led to a default in a money market, breaking the buck, as it was called, because when you have your money in your money markets, at least you expect a dollar for a dollar. It's like your checking account, just with a little bit more interest. But now it became 97 cents, and all of the money market funds said, "The heck with this. We're not putting money into commercial paper. We're not putting money into the banking sector. We're not putting money into investment banks anymore." And so the lifeblood of the economy in the day-to-day management, the liquidity, has frozen up for now. It's like going into shock, actually. There's just no circulation right now. You can't borrow. That's why Arnold Schwarzenegger said California is going to run out of funds in 6 weeks, because California can't borrow in the money markets now. Nobody wants to lend in the short term. Yesterday's bailout solves none of this. It's supposed to make us feel good. Excuse me. Yes. Do you feel good? Not so good, because the capital structure and the liquidity of the system continues to contract. Okay. So this is why we're going into a serious recession right now. Almost surely unavoidable as a downturn. The fight right now is to stop it from going into a real spasm of breakdown of even short-term financing, which would turn it from a downturn into a real crisis. The Fed can probably do that, because the Fed does have the printing press behind it in the end. That's going to prove to be handy. Hundreds of billions of dollars should be lent easily to keep the short-term money moving until panic does subside. But in the meantime, households will be squeezed and businesses will be squeezed. Households that borrowed heavily are going to need to work out, and the banking sector is going to need years to recapitalize. And none of that's going to be fixed in the short term. What does this mean for us in the short term, and what does it mean for strategy for our government, and what does it mean for strategy for energy? It means, first of all, these are going to be a difficult year or two, without question. So be prudent, be careful, because there's going to be no quick turnaround. You don't need me to tell you that. You can sense that day to day, but it's true, because nothing that's being done right now can quickly solve the unwinding of a massive bubble and years of neglect. The budget deficit was widening considerably because we live in a fantasy world where it's not patriotic to pay taxes, where somehow we want government for nothing. And we still don't have an honest discussion about this. The grossest dishonesty was the tax cuts for the wealthy, without question. This was an age when the wealthy were doing fine in the marketplace. They didn't need tax cuts on top of it. That was just gross, gross, gross abuse. The fact that McCain still supports this is so shocking as to not even know where to start. But the idea that there's lots of middle-class tax cuts around and lots of fiscal stimulus also seems to me to be wrong-headed. Because the budget deficit's going to be about $500 billion now because of the decline of revenues coming in, the loss of corporate earnings, a declining economy, a tax base that is already deeply degraded by the Bush triple tax cuts. And so I don't personally see where new fiscal stimulus is going to come from. And if we do fiscal stimulus, my thought would be that tax cuts are the wrong way to go, because our government is without the revenues that it needs to carry out basic functions. So let me morph just a little bit into government functions and energy strategy. Right now, the government spends about 20% of GNP, and the federal government, and it collects about 16% of GNP. So that's a $500 or $600 billion deficit. We just decided we're not going to pay for taxes, and they keep trying to fit a set of needs into an amount that doesn't work. There is no more waste to cut in the federal government. This idea that the $18 billion of earmarks could mean something is totally absurd. It's like the drill, baby, drill. This is just fantasy world, ladies and gentlemen. Our economy is $15 trillion. 1% of that's $150 billion. $18 billion of the earmarks, if you took that number, is 0.1% of GNP. For a budget deficit now of 4% of GNP, probably, when the recession kicks in. So what are we talking about? What conceivably do they think? They think they can fool everybody again. That's all they think. And they may be able to, who knows? But it has nothing to do with anything. We have budget needs that are far larger than our tax system can support right now. McCain wants to give it all away and cut spending. Now, where's the spending right now of that 20% of GNP? 4.5% is military. That's not going to be cut under McCain's plan. And another 2% is interest payments. And another 6%, 8% actually is, 10% is entitlements of various sorts, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans payments. The discretionary budget, so-called, all the stuff that's either not mandated or interest payments or the military, it's about 3.5% of GNP. That's what we're supposed to do, our roads, our bridges, our science, our energy policy, our education. It's all supposed to come out of this almost non-existent amount of money right now. So we don't have the federal revenues to do the things we really need to do. We can't afford to go on with this mythology that we can keep taxes low and somehow meet basic needs of our society. Keep the roads, the bridges, and adequate infrastructure, our kids going to school, halfway decent schools, a knowledge economy, a new energy system for climate change. And that's even before we took on $700 billion yesterday on which interest needs to be paid. That won't break the bank, actually, because we're a big economy. We'll pay interest on it. It shows money's there when something's important. It actually won't kill us by ourselves, that amount. Remember, $15 trillion, so that's 5% of GNP, and then you pay interest on that. So that's manageable. It's just not a good plan. That's a different matter. Doesn't solve the problems, but it is a manageable amount. But we have still not come to grips in our country with the need to make public investments. We're still living in the world where somehow these problems either don't exist or markets are going to solve them. And so we're still halfway between middle class tax cuts, but let the rich pay more, or tax cuts for everybody, including corporate and the rich. Now, that's the extreme fantasy. But even the middle ground right now is pretty unrealistic if we want to get things done. I wasn't too happy a camper when I heard the one thing that the Democratic side might postpone is foreign assistance. Just to let you know, that's tiny. Absolutely tiny. And I wouldn't have thought that we want the poorest of the poor to die for our sins, to put it in an unpleasant way. Because it's life and death, that stuff. That's not fun, that's not waste, that's not stupid. That's actually seeds and fertilizer to grow food, that's medicines, that's bed nets, those are really important things. That's water in drought-ridden areas. That's not a game. That's security on the planet, and it's life and death for millions and millions of people. We don't know it. We never hear about it. It's the least popular part of the budget. People don't understand that it's less than 0.2% of our national income. It's nothing. But it's the expendable part. Make people feel good, and so on. So we're still not really in a framework where we understand that we're going to have to start taxing ourselves more to meet public needs, change the way our budget works, living in negative personal saving as we did for the last 8 years, borrowing heavily on home values and so on. It just can't go on this way because no one's going to lend for that, and the retrenchment has come. We have to make the most of a realistic situation at this point. And what this means is that there's going to be a squeeze and tough. We have to avoid a crack up of the short-term economy, and we have to reorient from consumption to saving and reorient from a no-government sector to one where government is partner again with the private sector to address needs. Now, on the energy side, and I'll stop here, right now we've been spending total in our energy research, all energy research and development, nuclear, wind, solar, batteries, biofuels, everything, we've been spending $3.2 billion a year. To put that in perspective, we spend $1.9 billion a day on the military. One of the main reasons we spend $1.9 billion a day is energy insecurity. We fight wars in the Middle East because of energy, but we don't invest even 2 days of military spending to find alternatives, real alternatives. There are real alternatives. Energy independence is probably not a realistic alternative, but safe, clean, and more plentiful energy that taps into large-scale solar power, for example, is a real alternative. Engineers at Columbia have scoped out plans for the kind of mass solar power that has already been proved in the Mojave Desert and could be expanded tremendously, so-called solar thermal or concentrated solar power. There are actually many technologies for concentrating solar power in the desert. If one then had long-distance transmission lines, which is hundreds of billions of dollars of investment, we could have half of U.S. electricity needs or more even fed by the one site of the Mojave Desert. Other parts of the world in a similar way. The Sahara could provide all the electricity that Africa needs, North Africa, all the electricity that Europe needs. The Gobi Desert, vast amounts for China. The potential is there. Battery power, we've been investing a few tens of millions of dollars in batteries, but that's the difference between having proper battery-powered vehicles that could get three or four or five times the mileage per gallon that we get right now. So we could have an clean electricity grid-based system that also feeds into tremendously reduced dependency on petroleum. We haven't even begun to spend on these. We could also have safe nuclear power, something that I'm in favor of and that I think, as controversial as it is, many people are coming around to understand that compared to almost all alternatives, this should be part of the mix and will be for at least two dozen countries, whether or not for the United States, because most of Asia is relying heavily on a big nuclear expansion. Many countries in Europe similarly, and it's probably a good idea for the United States as well. In the end, though, we're going to have to invest and pay for this because this is not going to happen on its own. And it will never happen without leadership. And it will never happen with leadership that doesn't know what causes climate change. That would be us, ladies and gentlemen. Ask around today if you have any doubts. This is the world center of knowledge, literally, on this subject. It will not happen unless we have a government that understands that it is a core responsibility to set the framework in which the private sector can act. That's the framework for the financial markets, it's the framework for public finance, the budget, and it's the framework for the physical environment. I believe that 28 years into this Reagan era, we've reached the end. The country is really, in a way, on its knees right now. The economy is hemorrhaging, the financial sector is broken, the public policy is broken, the public discourse has been broken. There's nothing gargantuan even about the amounts that need to be invested or the kinds of change that is needed. We really are rich, just poorly guided, poorly led, poorly regulated, poorly governed. That means by ourselves as well, because we keep voting for these poorly governing governments. So that's our responsibility in the end. But there's nothing that is beyond the economic means to solve these problems. Ending extreme poverty is less than 1% of world income. Solving the climate change crisis, from the calculations that I and many others have made, are probably on the order of about 1% as well. Avoiding financial calamity is free. It's just being more clever not to turn the party over to those who are making it, but keep some sense of grown-up supervision as the party is getting underway. That's free. It's only the cost when we fail to do that. So the point, ladies and gentlemen, just to end, is moving to a new trajectory is not beyond our means. We haven't lost the wealth, the income, the capacity to do it. What we've lost is the direction. We've lost the quality of public discussion. We may have a chance, however, to get it back soon. Thank you very much. I ran on too long, but I want to take some questions, and with apologies to the program. Please, can you quickly tell us your name and then ask a question? On nuclear, the safest seems to be storage on site right now till longer-term solutions are found. The amount of waste is thousands of the dangerous wastes of carbon dioxide that go into the air, so it's not large quantities. It is a security issue. And the most likely good security approach right now is on-site storage, of which there are many existing and proposed technologies. They are not the definitive long-term solution, but they are a safe and prudent short-term solution. With regard to clean coal, I disagree. The essence of the coal issue is the following. Coal inherently creates carbon dioxide. That's how the energy is released. The question mainly is whether the carbon dioxide is released into the air, as it is now, or whether it can somehow be captured and safely sequestered. And the two ways that that might happen would be first at the power plant itself through many technologies, post-combustion or pre-combustion, that would separate the carbon dioxide from the in the combustion process, put it in a pipeline, store it underground. All that technology is known. We should have tried this in demonstration plants during the last 8 years. That's one of the ways that we've wasted our time. And it's probably the most important thing to try right now. I may be wrong, but most engineers think that this would be modest cost and feasible on a significant scale. The other two aspects of coal are that there are other pollutants, and a lot is known about how to reduce or eliminate their exhaust through various technologies at the plant, and the environmental soundness in the places where coal is mined, which is also something that needs to be taken into account. But coal is our most plentiful, least expensive fossil fuel right now. And the idea that there will be no use of coal would be an extraordinarily expensive cost of change. It's a cost I don't think we want to bear, because the alternatives, if we don't have coal, would be dramatically more expensive right now. And I can also tell you with high assurance, China and India are going to use their coal. They're going to use it in very large amounts, whether Vice President Gore says so or not, because that's their most plentiful and secure form of energy for 2.3 billion people, and they're going to use it. So I don't agree with the comment, and I think we should be thinking much harder about what are the right technologies that need to be tested and deployed. What is true is that we can't go on using coal the way we're using it without calamity. That's absolutely true. Yes?
Yeah. My name is Norman Cullough, and I have two quick questions. What is the stage or state of breeder reactors as a way of reducing the need for storage of nuclear waste on site? There's a lot of talk about breeder reactors, yeah, but I don't know what the status is. And the other concern I have is, since these countries such as India and China growing so many coal plants, like China one a week, what about the problem of carbon drifting and how we can control that? Because it takes about 20
Sure.
And how can we ameliorate that?
Look, carbon dioxide mixes uniformly in the atmosphere within 30 days. So anybody's carbon is everybody's carbon. That's why we need a global agreement. It is a concept we once had in this country called diplomacy. And it's another thing I recommend for the world, because we are not living in the Truman Show despite all appearances to the contrary. We do not have a giant bubble over this country, and we cannot control our climate. China will emit more carbon dioxide than the United States into the future. So China has become the number one emitter in the world. We need an agreement. I work a lot with the Chinese leadership. I think China will reach an agreement with the United States once we have a strategy, an approach, diplomacy, serious discussion. So I think that's feasible. But you're absolutely correct. It's not drift. It is everybody's carbon is the sum of what everybody does. The breeder reactor, the technology exists. The problem is the mass creation of fissile materials. The danger of the breeder reactor is the out of control and possibly out of monitoring of mass production of fissile materials. So it's a proliferation problem, not a technology problem, principally. Yes? Pickens Wind, yeah. Well, wind is an absolutely viable strategy. It requires, however, transmission lines, because where the wind is and where the people are very different. We need public policy to say we need basically a new national infrastructure for energy transmission. And wind is part of the problem, solar is part of the problem, breakdowns of our existing distribution system is another part of the problem. So wind will definitely play a role. It probably is not at the scale of solar, nuclear, and fossil fuel. It's probably at a smaller scale, but it's a significant scale. And the economics work out. And they especially work out once you take into account the damage from carbon dioxide and either put a tax on carbon dioxide, which would be a good thing to do, or have some kind of tradable permit system. I personally favor a tax. It raises revenue. We need the revenue. Yes, please. Well, you know, I'm not an expert on the most detailed parts of this, but clearly you put the lines themselves up physically in places where they already exist, but we need high transmission direct current lines, for example, which have a lot less loss than the alternating current high voltage lines that we currently have. So the idea is a different technology to carry vast amounts of electricity. But the physical placement could be, to an important extent, on current lines along highways and along the current grid, but it's a different technology for carrying and transmitting the electricity. Yes?
Just a short statement and a question.
Sure.
You mentioned that the Reagan administration, that Clinton and Bush, to some extent, were to blame for not having a proper national energy strategy. But I remember when I was in college, a lot of people in the liberal establishment were very opposed to nuclear energy.
Right.
We remember Three Mile Island, and so I think both sides were to blame for the failure to have a national strategy on energy throughout all the administration.
I agree with that. The biggest problems, of course, right now we have hybrid, which is functioning and expanding. Europe uses diesel, which gets about 70 miles to the gallon right now in some vehicles. The bigger gains can come in two ways. One is the plug-in hybrid, of course, which basically adds 30 or 40 miles of battery life at the beginning of each driving day, or pure battery driven, which is what a number of automakers are investing, or hydrogen. Now, the hydrogen storage problem has not been solved at all, and the problem of the electricity is basically the battery, its durability, its performance, its longevity, its safety. It looks, from what I can gather, again, as a consumer of the literature and in active discussions, that that's close to being solved. So important battery breakthroughs.
Solved here in this country or in Asian markets?
Well, I think a lot of people are working on the battery challenge right now. Japanese companies, GM is putting out its Chevy Volt in 2010, they say. Korea is investing heavily and has made advances in battery technology. You would have thought, I would think, I should say, also, that this is important for American competitiveness. Investing in technological advance is actually not only good for the environment, it's good for the economy. That's another idea that we dropped quite a long time ago. I mean, public investment. So I think that strategically, as a matter of strategic and industrial policy, that would be the right thing to do. Now, both with hydrogen and with electric-powered vehicles, those are both fuel carriers. They're not primary energy sources. Hydrogen has to be produced. If it's produced by fossil fuels, you have to collect the carbon dioxide to make it clean. If it's produced by renewables, those renewables could be put into the grid rather than into hydrogen. So there are lots of technological pathways, hard to choose among them 10 or 20 or 30 years out, but what looks most promising 2 years out is electric-powered vehicles with an increasingly clean electricity grid. And perhaps the main way for that, in my view, is solar, looking 20 to 30 years out. Solar and nuclear are both large-scale, clean, or zero-emitting technologies where we could really, in effect, tremendously clean up the automobile emissions, which are about a third of the U.S. total emissions right now. Okay, one more, and then I'm told to pull the plug. Please. Yeah.
Why have we given up on that?
So, again, there are three different things going on Wall Street. One is a contraction of credit. That puts the economy into a recession, which is happening. Second is a loss of banking capital. That constricts the ability in the medium term to make new industrial loans through the formal banking system. Banks need to be recapitalized. The third is the complete collapse of interbank credit lines, commercial paper, money market funding. The third is where we're teetering. I don't think it will happen, partly because if it did, it would be so calamitous that it must not be allowed to happen. We know enough, I think, for that not to happen. It's basically for the Fed to throw open its rediscounting facilities and say, you have short-term credit lines. We don't want you defaulting on day-to-day or week-to-week paper. The reason that's so important is that if that closes up, then companies can't get their working capital. They can't meet their payrolls. You get a decline of GNP of 10 or more percent, which is what happened in the Great Depression. We're not going to have one. So let me be clear. We're not going to have a Great Depression here. It's what happened in the Asia crisis where GNP fell by 10%. I think it's a small chance, but they're fighting feverishly to prevent it right now. If there's stupidity, it would happen. The people in charge are not stupid at the Fed. They're smart. And so if they're putting out the money, they can keep the liquidity going. We need a lot of international cooperation also to make sure it doesn't just ricochet to other banks. Ireland's banks were hit last week. They put a blanket guarantee on everything. French banks, UK banks, Indian banks, Italian banks. This has become a worldwide nerve-wracking fiasco right now. It requires a lot of cooperation. The biggest problem right now is we're at the end of a failed government. And so we're in an interregnum. And we have to get to January 20 without calamity. And then have a good outcome, by the way. Because that could be another calamity. We can't do this for four more years. We can't even go on for four more months of this kind of leadership. So we actually need a good outcome and a new president. Fusion is difficult. That's the reason why it's hard. And we gave up on large-scale science funding in this country. Not gave up, but we just don't do what we should do. Our total scientific R&D outside of defense is about 0.2% of GNP. This is absurd. This is just not thinking. There's no higher return than understanding the science and technology that we need for sustainability on the planet. We just don't invest in it. And we hear that budgets are tight. Budgets are tight only because we chose to make them tight. We could be spending 1% of GNP on these things easily, 2% of GNP. It actually matters for our future. The most important job for a president of the United States is to understand these things. We have not had that kind of leadership in a long time that said, here are the important things we need to do, here's where we're going to spend the money, and we're going to tax ourselves as a civilized country so that we can do the public investments we need to do so we can solve the problems we face. That's what we need to hear from a president. Thank you very much.